231-8032 to verify if a beating is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Dingo, is showing Tuesday, July 18th at 7 p.m. Miles Davis made his only acting appearance in this film about a jazz trumpeter who dares to realize his musical dreams in the Australian outback. The film also has an award-winning Miles Davis soundtrack.
Did you like the music?
Again, that's Dingo, showing Tuesday, July 18th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Gotta go now, John, before they take off and leave me. Nice meeting you.
KBOO Portland.
And coming up on KBOO Portland at 9 o'clock, it's Pacific Underground. That's right. Calling out fascism in a time of divided politics and other topics. At 10, Air Cascadia features headlines, interviews, and commentary with your host, Chris Andre, followed at 10:15 with Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, a Radio Geekly kicks off summer with a discussion on comics and how they can be used as tools for social justice. And thank you to all KBOO members for your generous support. Those who have not yet made that hard left turn into, well, from passive consumption to active membership in the KBOO Foundation can rectify that mistake at kboo.fm, and you click on the word donate. That's all coming up on your community radio, so stay tuned.
All right, you're listening to Pacific Underground, the show where Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, and other hyphenated people from the Asiatic nations originally get on the microphone and talk about our lives and our politics and the things that we go through that normally don't receive voice. Today we are kind of flying by the seat of our collective pants. Yes, we are wearing one pair of pants as a collective.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're beautiful pants, though.
Yeah, they're great. They're comfy.
Large pair of
they're
pants.
They're spacious.
Mm-hmm. A lot of elastic there on the waistband.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all fitting in together.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
cozy.
Yeah.
It's cozy in here.
Yeah.
Anyway, we don't have a guest. We thought we were going to have a guest. We thought we might have had two guests, but turns out we have zero guests. But that is
Doodle
the
life.
Way...
Yeah, I feel like we need to give a little shout out to our guests. You know,
they didn't just flake out.
His car got broken
yeah.
into. We'll just say that. So we wish
things
you luck.
Happened.
Sorry. Thanks, guest. But hopefully we'll have, and that was Jacob Alejandro from Direct Action Alliance. And so hopefully we'll be able to have him on. Yeah, in the future. So we're not going to end up talking about anti-fascism specifically today, which is the work that Direct Action Alliance does. So instead, we're just sort of going to talk about whatever we feel like talking about today.
Asians in the news.
There's all sorts of Asians in the news. So I guess we should do some introductions. Who's on the air this morning? I'm Jenna.
I'm Kanan.
And I'm Tabitha.
We're the Pacific Islander crew, or Pacific Underground crew. Wow. We've not had enough coffee this morning. Woo.
Sadly, we don't have any Pacific Islander representation. But hey, if there are any Pacific Islanders out there that would like to join our crew, just stop by KBOO.
A little plug there. Yeah, if you want to join the Pacific Underground crew, send us a message, email us, whatever. You know, Pacific
stop
Underground.
By KBOO,
yeah,
become a volunteer.
Pacific Underground at KBOO.org.
And yes, we are embarrassed. We are embarrassed that we don't have
Yeah,
any
we are. Yeah, it's a deep part of our shame. And as Asians, it runs deep.
Yeah,
it
runs Asian deep. Shame.
You can find us on social media, on Facebook and Twitter at PAC Underground. Again, that's PAC Underground. So if you're out there and you're like, oh my gosh, I need to be on that show because you guys are just not cutting it, give us a call or give us a message. So let's talk about what happened this week. Can we talk about July 4th?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I hate that holiday.
Yeah.
What happened?
It's Freedom America Day.
Yeah.
It was Freedom America Day on Tuesday.
It is my least favorite holiday because the ultra-patriotism comes out around July 4th, and it just makes me so sick. And especially since the election of Donald Trump, I'm just, like, feeling the least patriotic that I have felt in a long time.
You mean you didn't put on your full flag outfit?
Unfortunately, I didn't. I left my flag outfit in the closet this year. Plus, if I did, it might have like a China flag on it.
Ooh,
or even better,
China.
I know, China. Yeah, or even better, what's his face's other favorite country?
Oh, Russia.
Yeah.
If you had a Russia, China, America outfit. That feels like very America.
I could have like Chinese pants, a Russian top, and like an American flag cape.
America.
America.
Kanan, what did you do for July 4th? Well, I saw you on July 4th. I'm like trying to block that day out.
We were at the park hanging out with the AAPRP for the 4th of July event, which was great way to stand.
Who are the AARP? Yeah.
Not the AARP. That's a different organization.
Okay. That's retired folks.
But I did hear someone conflate the two yesterday, and it was very, very funny. Anyway, it's the All African People's Revolutionary Party.
Okay.
Yes, very different. Two very different goals there.
Okay.
Goals. One's a lobbyist group, and the other one just refuses to participate in the American government. In the political system.
Yeah. But it was a good way to stand against imperialism and against white supremacy, against various systems of oppression. And we just kind of had like a little picnic in the park. And
Nice.
Then we lit a certain cloth that has stars and stripes on it on fire. It was symbolic of something.
Did a little flag burning.
We flag burned. And it felt good.
Yeah, it did. You know, it was like, you think, okay, 4th of July, and I bet a lot of people imagine this just like, I don't know, violent, screaming out against America. And then but it was just a picnic. It was just an awesome, like, chill picnic of people just like all sitting around saying, yeah, I want to enjoy my day off with other people, and let's do the picnic barbecue thing and eat awesome mac salad. And also acknowledge that today is a really horrific, traumatizing day for millions and millions of people in this country and around the world. So that was my first time going to like a specifically like anti-Independence Day event. I've pretty much just like kind of avoided celebrating. Like, I just haven't done barbecues
and
stuff. So that was really interesting.
How did y'all used to feel about 4th of July like as a child or as a kid?
My first memory of 4th of July was one of absolute terror. I was like,
what?
I don't even remember where I was, but I just hate the fireworks. It was just like such loud thudding, and I didn't know what was happening.
Were these like fireworks in the air? Was it like the kind that you do like at home?
No, these were like the ones in the air that like make the ground shake.
Oh, yeah.
And they were like really close. I don't even remember where I was, but I remember like inconsolably just sobbing.
Aww.
And being terrorized.
But I want to say that you sounded like you're a pretty awake kid. You got some wokeness going on.
Yeah,
why?
They were tears for our ancestors and repression and
were they white tears?
Imperial subjugation abroad.
No,
they were not white tears.
He had yellow tears of just, oh God, look at my oppression being pushed in my face as something beautiful.
Well, as a multiracial person, there were different color tears.
Yeah. Rainbow tears flowing down your cheeks.
Wow. Wait, so did you ever, like, did your family do, like, annual barbecue or anything like that?
Yeah, there was a lot of that happened later. I you know, stepped into my childhood and became brainwashed, as pretty much everyone does who doesn't grow up in like a super radical family. And I thought it was cool. You know, I like lighting things on fire. I like blowing things up. It's fun. I was a little boy once. Yeah, and I think
I would like to say little girls can also enjoy explosions.
And I have a feeling that you still kind of like lighting things on fire because I do.
I do. Yeah. It's like that is one aspect of 4th of July that I do enjoy. I do enjoy barbecues and, enjoying my day off. And I do enjoy fireworks, but the ultra patriotism... Don't like that.
Yeah, I like the fireworks. Like this year, I think this is like the last year or something that we can do fireworks in Multnomah County. Is that it?
Is that real?
Something, I don't know. But I just knew that we had like leftover fireworks from last year. And even though every part of me didn't want to like celebrate the holiday, I just wanted to take advantage of the fact that it's like the one day of the year you can actually let off fireworks. So we like did sparklers in the backyard and stuff like that. And so I like to think that I'm celebrating Chinese people with their invention of the gunpowder. Mm-hmm. And when I was celebrating,
you're welcome.
Yeah, Tabitha, thank you. Thank you and all your people for just wanting things
for making gunpowder and making things go boom.
Well, what about you, Tabitha? How was it for you when you were a kid?
I like the 4th of July because I saw it as hanging out with my family, having a picnic or a barbecue, and then when the sun went down, setting off explosions. Boom. I've always hated the noise-making fireworks, like the ones that...
Oh, whistly.
I feel bad I'm going to say this because I feel like someone's going to play this prank on me, but the worst possible prank you could ever play on me...
Everyone take notes.
I know, right? Is to light off a noise-making firework and not warn me, and then, like, I might start crying.
Oh, no!
Because ever since I was a kid, I do not know, like, wee! Noise making fireworks.
Well, so fireworks aside, for because I did fireworks as a kid too. Mm-hmm. Like my grandparents were on a farm, and so like my grandpa would buy like the super big box, and we just like let them all off like at one time, because you know we all want to go to bed early, so we just like let them all at once. But what was your understanding of the holiday as a kid? Like how did you interpret it as a child? Was it like about freedom? Was it about the Revolutionary War? Like, what was your feeling about it? What was your understanding?
For me, it was just family time. It was just hanging out with my family, enjoying our day off, and setting off fireworks. And then it was in my mid-20s, I went to this, to a 4th of July celebration, super patriotic. Like, it was a neighborhood celebration, and, like, the neighborhood... like pooled money together to go buy fireworks from, this was in Seattle, and I guess there is an Indian reservation there where they sell the really illegal kinds of fireworks outside of the reservation, and bought a bunch of those, and they had like an actual neighborhood organized like fireworks display. And the year I went, they also got someone that lived along the block to sing the national anthem, and I just felt...
Wait, like they sang the national anthem at your block party?
Yeah, at this neighborhood 4th of July party.
Ew.
Yeah,
weird.
And it just...
That's
weird. Yeah, okay, and it felt like... And I felt super awkward, because that's like the first ultra-patriotic 4th of July celebration that I'd ever been to. It's like, this is not my scene.
And so did that make you like... decide, okay, I want to celebrate this holiday, but I don't want to celebrate it like that? Or was that a moment of like kind of a light bulb, like, oh, whoa, well, this holiday is, oh my gosh, I really need to think about this.
No, that was my light bulb moment. It's like, I should rethink about celebrating 4th of July, because I would prefer to live in this country compared to others, there is still a lot of self-criticism and like self-examination that we all need to do that I feel like is just not done on 4th of July. And we just celebrate this country just to celebrate this country without questioning this country. And so that is my big criticism of 4th of July.
What about you, Kanan? Like, when did you have that shift from it being like, hey, this is barbecues, to being like, oh, God?
I don't really know. I honestly don't know, but I do remember growing up in San Diego, it was just all about like my neighborhood, and I didn't really care about what the context was. I never really thought it was genuine or significant at all. Whatever the backstory was, that goes for pretty much any holiday. Like it just didn't feel real. It mm-hmm. just felt like a kind of like veneer and just an excuse to act differently and do different things on that given day where we don't have to go to work or whatever, or go to school. That was like, that was the main upshot, not having to go to school
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it's important now. And I think I had this sense back then as well, as like, what does this holiday mean for people who are indigenous? My growing up, my best friend was Navajo, is Navajo still.
And they had that surgery like in Tropic Thunder, and they changed
oh,
races.
Oh God.
No, we're not
oh,
going
God,
there.
Oh God, no.
Anyway, there's that was always really interesting. I don't really remember what his and his family's stance was on the 4th of July, but I can only imagine. And I can only imagine what that's like, what the dissonance is like on, you know, in communities, like on reservations where they are selling fireworks, and they're selling fireworks yeah. for a country, you know, that literally decimated their ancestors, took away their land, perpetrated war crimes and genocide on them, and are responsible for their current situation of economic ruin and complete abject poverty. Mm-hmm. So that's a hard thing to think about, and I don't think I really understood how to think about it, but I think I knew that there was something wrong as I was like eating barbecued chicken and like watching everyone kind of like, I don't know, be happy for some reason that I couldn't really understand, besides like the loud booms and like the beer, you know?
Yeah.
And the block parties. Block parties are fun, but
yeah. But still, yeah, no, I felt like growing up, to me, like most holidays were like what I called in my head, like American holidays. It was like, hey, we live in America, so therefore we celebrate these holidays that Americans celebrate. But I didn't necessarily feel connected to the holidays, right? Like I never really felt like, oh, Thanksgiving, I'm so grateful that the pilgrims landed. You know, it was like, oh, look at this white man holiday where we get to eat turkey. And I felt really, really disconnected from it. And so I don't think I felt that controversy. I have like vague recollections of my mom not like lecturing us about the holiday, but kind of being like every once in a while, like dropping little hints that like she found it problematic as well. Like you're like, oh yeah, I guess this is celebrating freedom. And she'd be like, yeah, freedom. Sucks if you're Native American. You know, like she would mm-hmm. sort of like say that sort of thing. And I think maybe like as I got older, because I remember by the time I was like in high school, it was like, wait a minute. I just like barbecue chicken and fireworks. Oh, okay. That's what I really want this holiday to be. And yeah. And I remember like high school probably being around the time like figuring out that like what we called democracy was actually capitalism and that sort of thing. And just like feeling increasingly uncomfortable with that fact. And then also having a hard time with fireworks because everyone's just, ooh, and ah. And then to realize like, oh, wow, this actually just like represents the bombing of, oh, everyone around the world, you know, it's just so difficult. And then I feel like mm-hmm. as I started to get more connected with my own heritage and my understanding of what it was to be an American, it was like, oh my God, I'm an American. This isn't like some white man holiday, even though it totally like is in a way by being here and being an American and celebrating, I'm taking part of it. And I'm just like furthering the oppression by like finding this to be awesome. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now these days it's usually, oh, it's a day off. And so that's why I was glad to have the picnic to go to be like, well, no, I also don't feel like ignoring it. I would like to do something that like actively like talks about what my stance is, which is this day is not okay. Like why? Sure, let's have a holiday that celebrates democracy. We would all love to live in an actual democracy. Let's talk about, you know, people actually having equality and actually having freedom. I would love to have that holiday where we actually are having a day that celebrates like equality, equity for like everybody, but that holiday is clearly not here.
Maybe we can start an Equity Day holiday.
Oh God, I think it's like two centuries off. Well, because you know this kind of maybe kind of relates, but you know how Canada Day was celebrated, you know, this last week, or was it last
July
week?
July 1st.
Yeah, July 1st. And I thought that was really interesting that, you know, there was a lot of pushback and there was like that whole hashtag campaign that really called out the Canadian government for being like, excuse me, you're spending $200 million on nationwide like celebrations. Oh, but you don't have money to take care of like the Indigenous Canadians, and you don't have like the resources for schools and for like medical and just like to keep their water clean. And so I was glad that there was that pushback, because I want that on July 4th every year. People are just like, are we really free? Is it really freedom?
I was listening to the On the Media podcast, and they had a story about the anti-patriotism that happens in
Canada.
Were
you listening to something that isn't cable?
I'm sorry.
Ooh, Tabitha. Traitor.
Shame.
America.
Shame. But I thought that was really interesting that this was the first time that I ever heard that Canada had like sort of this pushback against like, let's celebrate Canada Day. It's like, no, we shouldn't, because we still have all these problems.
Well, yeah, because people love to think of like Canada as like, let's all escape to Canada and Canada's so great and they don't have any of the problems.
Yeah, like the socialist paradise.
Yeah, and then you talk to Canadians and they're like, no, we're all just like really nice racist. Like, it's not any different. Just like, oh, but then when people in Canada say that, I'm like, oh, that sounds nice. Because if it's going to be there, I'd rather have it be nice racist.
Yeah, than passive aggressive.
Isn't that also the lie that kind of brought us to this city, though?
Oh, yeah.
That everyone's so nice in Portland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we're
really
passive-aggressive.
Yeah, and it when I think about it, I'm glad you brought up that point, because I will say that one of my complaints about Portland has been, like, I'd rather have people just be mean and blatantly racist to my face than the way we do here. So I'd probably like being Canada, throwing poutine at everyone, being like, get mad, come on.
And at the end of all your sentences.
Get mad, eh? So there's me stereotyping about Canadians.
Yeah.
But they really do say eh. I've been to Canada and people say eh.
They do say
Not
eh.
everybody, but I love it when they do it.
They do.
I giggle and smile.
And I've also heard some Canadians speak with that sort of Midwestern accent, or like the Dakota eh.
Oh, yeah.
Don't you know?
Oh, yeah.
So maybe I could deal with it. I don't know. And I just want to live in Vancouver, just because it's 45% Asian these days. And I'm like, that sounds like...
And I love it whenever I hear a Canadian say process.
We could go through all the fun Canadian words.
Sorry, Canadians. I love your accent. fetishizing Canadians.
But 4th of July, that happened.
Yeah, I mean, also, I think it's important to like think about what the symbolism of 4th of July is. You know, it's just like the fireworks are American militarism, and like,
I know, I figured that out like in my at that same 4th of July celebrations, like, these fireworks are symbolizing bombs and gunshots. Like, I don't know if I'm comfortable.
I mean, talking about like, you know, at your block party where they had people singing the national anthem, that's freaking awkward. But I remember learning all the words to the national anthem in junior high school. And, you know, you learn, like, you know, the full poem. And it was like, oh, this is messed up. This is just, like, about, like, God and, like, killing people. It was, like, all about white supremacy. And I think I remember that being one of those first, like, hello, let's talk about 4th of July, how problematic this is. You know, just like, I remember us talking about that in our English class, of just like how problematic the Star Spangled Banner was, and like, why was it this song versus like another song, and like, why did we choose these words? And I just remember my class, that was probably like one third Asian people, just being like, oh, white people and their crazy patriotism. Like, because like, it's not even talking about how like great this country is, like beautifully, you know. It's like, oh no, it's just like, we're so good at kicking.
We're so good at shooting people and firing bombs.
Yeah, go us.
America.
I think the big contradiction, we can move on after this. Sorry, I keep bringing us back into this conversation. But like, the biggest contradiction for me is just seeing how like jubilant and celebratory everyone is, while also like knowing that the U.S. government has killed millions of people over the course. Hundreds of millions, probably. Maybe like tens of millions alone on the soil just to establish the country that exists today.
Yeah.
But like abroad, hundreds of millions. And that you know, we set off these bombs to celebrate that fact and to celebrate like American exceptionalism and our hegemony around the world. Meanwhile, we're re-traumatizing all of the people that have done that work, done the killing on behalf of our country, because they associate those noises and those experience with their experiences of, like, you know, seeing people die, you know, acquiring like psychological pain and disorder afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I always think about veterans, like the past, like, I don't know, 5 years, I've just thought about like all the veterans that, like, and how they deal with that, because that's so real. That's, it's like a thing that I don't hear very many veterans speaking up about, but I think that's just starting to come into the discussion of like all the different things that we've mentioned that accompany 4th of July, and bringing a little bit more of like an actual analysis to the holiday and why we celebrate it. And like, it turns out, also side note, that I don't think like the 4th is not actually like historically that significant in terms of our independence. Like, I think that was just like one of many different events when the document was
one,
like,
one joke I like to tell, it's like, did you know they have 4th of July in England? And then people are like, they do? What do they do there? It's like, it's just the 4th of July.
But yeah, it was just like a day, I think, when like the, I don't know, Continental Congress pushed the document and like, I don't know, had it published or something. Anyway,
because it wasn't like the day that the American government was actually established, right?
No,
no,
it was just the signing of the,
they just signed the Declaration of Independence.
where they call the indigenous people savage and all sorts of other ridiculous declarations. Yeah, yeah. So
and
it's like,
all men are created equal, but you still own slaves.
Yeah, like why specifically this day? Because people just want to have like a day, and like, but you know what's even stranger to me about Americans in general when it comes to the fireworks thing is how removed people want it to be. And I do this too, where, okay, I admit it, I went down to the Tillicum Bridge and like I watched the fireworks. I'd never actually gone down to the waterfront to see it before, and I wanted to see like what this was about. And you know, everyone's just oohing and aahing, and I really think that, like, you know, your average modern day American is not sitting there thinking, oh, this is like symbolic of the bombing of these people and these people. Everyone's just like, oh, this is really pretty and this is really fun. And ooh, look, it's the one that goes boom and then boom again. I mean, that's the one I like, you know, and stuff like that. And it's sad to me that it, how do I put this? It sort of feels like, you know, how we're always comparing the American imperialism to like the Roman Empire, where it's just like, oh, let's put on these shows to distract the public. And like, oh, look at, here's how fireworks, it's pretty bombing, right? It's just like distracting us from what it's actually symbolizing, and nobody wants to talk about it. And then when you talk about like, well, you know, it's symbolizing like killing people, everyone's just like, oh, but I like fireworks. I like fireworks. It's pretty. And I am that same way too.
It's funny you mentioned the Romans, because we do have the Italians to thank for the pretty colors.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Chinese invented gunpowder, but when the Italians started trading with China, I don't know if it's due to Marco Polo, but they added like magnesium and like potassium and the other elements to create the pretty colors that you see in fireworks.
Well, thanks, Italians. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Italians.
Keep
us
deluded in the dream.
Yeah, exactly.
With the pretty colors.
But yeah, that's what just bothers me, is that it's not like people don't know, right? Like, we all took the junior high English class that taught us what it's about and whatever, you know, and yet it's still part of that American delusion. It's still something I think the government very much pushes, you know, because I was thinking about Ken Yoshikawa, right, the poet that we had on our last episode, and he did that poem here where it was referencing the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know, and I thought about that on the 4th of just like, oh yeah, so, that's what this is about. This is about that.
Go to sleep at night with that thought that fireworks symbolize an A-bomb.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that I'm supposed to just be like, oh, wait, but that created freedom. Freedom for us all. Yay. You know, and it's just like, whoa. Because the same excitement that I find on 4th of July is that same racist excitement that we find every year on the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. for some reason, you know, well, not for some reason, but, you know, the right conservative social blah, blah, blah people.
NRA people.
Yeah, like to love to celebrate it. They love to put out memes on the internet, and they like to still use the word Jap for some reason because they still think it's 1940 for some reason, you know. And so it's just like that enthusiasm over actually bombing people is like, that's what brings me back
to feeling disturbed.
Yeah, on July 4th, because I understand, like, we all like pretty shiny fire. Like, that's fun. But then when I'm like, oh, wow, that same enthusiasm I find on that anniversary every year, like, oh, this is irksome. Wait, real quick. It's almost like, wow, we're like halfway through our show and we've just been talking about this. So let's tell people what they're listening to. You're listening to Pacific Underground, by the way, if you're tuning in. We are the show that talks about, apparently, 4th of July and how us API folk are just over it. We be over in many, many ways. So you're listening to Pacific Underground here on KBOO.
Happy birthday,
Portland.
America.
Oh, gosh. Happy is, I don't need the word.
Yeah. Birthday, America?
Oh, can we talk about the last episode and how we can connect it to this episode?
Oh, yeah. Serendipity.
Oh, dude. Okay, so on the last episode, I went on this, like, rant where I talked about how I hate the opera, The Mikado, which we don't even need to get in.
I think the Portland Puppet Museum heard your rant.
I think they did, because, so if you don't know what The Mikado is, it's a opera that was written like in the late 1800s.
By Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yeah, it's written by these white European dudes, and they write a fictional story that takes place in what they literally call, quote unquote, fictional Japan, and it has characters that are called like ping
yum
pong.
Yum.
Yeah, yum yum, ping pong, and stuff like that. It's just, it's terribly racist. Yes,
yeah.
It's terribly racist. It is terribly racist.
I was reading the Wikipedia yesterday.
Okay, and so apparently, like, there's been a lot of professional productions of this opera being shut down, like in New York and Seattle. Like, professional opera companies are having their productions shut down before they even open because people are like, this is racist. Okay,
yay, but opera companies and wokeness?
The opera companies are not the ones shutting it down.
Yeah,
it's activists shutting them down. So anyhow, I see on the internet yesterday that there is a puppet troupe that is going to be doing an abridged version of Mikado with puppets, but
I would like to see,
drum roll please, they're not using puppets that look like people, they're using puppets that all look like pandas.
Yay! Because Japanese people are totally pandas.
Exactly. Japanese people are totally, and let's face it, when I think, who is a panda? A Chinese person is a panda.
I know.
Come on. Look at
I know,
you, Tabitha.
Right?
You just,
I am so a panda on the inside.
You're just sitting there gnawing on your bamboo.
Mm-hmm. Like, having a difficult time breeding. Finding a mate.
And then having like too much weird, awkward inbreeding. Like, yeah. The pandas are a mess. Anyhow, so the three puppeteers, at least they can see in the picture, are like white dudes. Anyhow, so I just thought it was very amusing that after my whole rant about how the Mikado is so racist and you can't keep doing stuff like the King and I and Miss Saigon, all this is racist, we need to let it go. Then this week, these guys
to
do.
I also want to imagine air quotes around abridged.
Yeah.
When you said that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just, because, I mean, it's a 3-hour opera that they've put into a 1-hour thing. And then on top of it, it's a parody kind of the opera. So then they like do terrible things like making fun of people. And then, okay, on the commercial. So they have like a little YouTube commercial. And I'll get off my rant here. Just got to describe this YouTube commercial real quick. Every time they say the word the Mikado, there's like this little voiceover that goes, Mikado. And you're just like, oh my God, this is so freaking Portland. And that's my feeling about it.
That's gross.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we can link that also to this sushi chef. Did we talk about this last week?
No.
Oh, gosh. We didn't.
Yeah.
Do you want
We got to talk about this.
I don't know if I have the full story at my fingertips right now, but it's essentially this, it's an American person, right? A U.S.
In New York.
Oh, a New York person who went and apparently studied culinary sushi arts in Japan for like 3 years or something, and then came back and is like essentially trying to lay claims to like reviving sushi or something, as if it needed reviving, or just kind of like
that he's super authentic,
that he's like the most authentic. And then apparently he says things in Japanese, which is not a problem, but he also says things in a mock, very contrived Japanese accent. And then he says things in English with a Japanese accent, you know, replacing the R's and L's. And so he says things like "delicious, delicious," which is like a direct translation of something you would say when you're serving it, but only in Japanese, which doesn't excuse it at all. It actually kind of like makes it more offensive to me, at least.
Yeah. Right, like so in like all the different articles that like picked up on this, they all talk about how he likes to use the word "oishi," which is means just
delicious
in Japanese. So he gives the food to the people, and he says "oishi," then he says "delicious." Why can't you just say "oishi"?
Yeah, like, I know, right?
Just be the impressive, like, white guy who can speak Japanese. Like, why do you have... And then, when people asked him about it, he said, it's just fun little jokes. And that, like, he can't help it that the accent comes out. That it's like, he must, like, think of himself, like, so much as Japanese.
So is it like Madonna and her weird British accent?
No. Okay, I will say that's different, and because I've always thought about the Madonna thing. I always thought it was a little bit weird. But at the same time, okay, so Madonna was, like, living in England.
Yeah.
And, right, if you imagine, like, a British person living in the United States for a few years, they're going to pick up a little bit of an American accent, right?
Yeah.
This dude is not living in Japan.
No, he's not living in Japan.
And, like, living amongst Japanese people who are, like, having an accent. This is a dude who can fully speak perfect American English, because he's an American, and then every once in a while needs to do stuff like that. Delicious. Like, why?
Yeah.
Why? Obviously, like, he's not serving Japanese people. That, mm-hmm. Or I wonder if when Japanese people come around, if he drops the accent because he knows better.
He code switches.
Maybe he doesn't even have that much sense. But I don't know. Like, when you start to deconstruct, like, why is that a joke and why is that acceptable? You being who you are, this, like, white man who has, you know, been graciously accepted into this institution of, like, traditional sushi preparation, you're now capitalizing off of that, which is fine, but you're doing so in a way that, like, sets into continuity this mockery and, like, complete ridiculing of people, of Asian people, that has been happening for, like, 200 years in this country, and that's just a little joke. Yeah. Right, that's just a little joke. So how is that okay? You know, like, you peel one layer back and it's immediately problematic. So I don't understand how. Hopefully, there's more pressure being applied to this person because
to
he sucks.
Stop this.
Yeah, and I don't know. For me, it's like I don't want this person to be ruined because of this. I think many people do, and that's totally rad too. But I think that there should be accountability.
I'd like to try his sushi and then have him ruined.
I would like for him to perform free labor and give free sushi to people of color, especially Japanese American.
I don't
want to
have to touch
people.
His sushi, though. I don't want to have to eat something he touched.
Well, I just want him to work until he's exhausted. and just give him, like, you know, it's like sentencing someone to hard labor. You know, you give him
a like
chance
$2 a
to
day,
have like some penitence.
Yeah. Like work 8 hours and stuff. And like, I think, you know, when this story came out, I kind of wondered if other like non-Japanese people or non-Asian people like understood why this seemed like a big deal to Asian people. And so for non-Asians who are maybe like, well, what's the big deal? He says like delicious, like, oh, that's so old fashioned to make fun of people that way. I'll just say that when this story came out, like I got this. Yeah. So the story that this came out like on June 30th, not what was that like a week before I had been mocked in the same way with somebody mixing up the L's and the R's and telling me that it was a joke and that this was a way they were trying to relate to me. Like they literally thought, like they knew that this was a quote, like non-PC joke, but they literally thought that this was acceptable humor and that I would find this funny.
No.
And the same person, in very much the exact same attitude, said that he felt that he had the right to speak this way because he had studied a lot about Asian culture and blah, blah, blah. And,
oh, well, clearly tell me about my culture.
Yeah, and that gave him the excuse to like use
was
these
kind
of
white person?
Yes, it was a white person. And like, I don't think they understand that. And you know, when it comes to that accent, like I'm actually pretty hypersensitive to it because even though I don't speak fluent Japanese anymore, like I did as a kid, and the one thing that I've retained from speaking Japanese is I have a very, very difficult time with L's and R's. I mix them up sometimes, they don't even notice, and sometimes even when people say things, like it's just difficult for me to pick up. I don't know why L's and R's are that way for Japanese people, but they all kind of sound like one big letter to me. And so when somebody mocks me, you know, or they're not even mocking me, they're just mocking Japanese people, I just...
You're feeling personally mocked.
Yeah, I feel personally attacked, and at the same time, I just want to yell at them and be like, I don't think you understand how many years it's taken for me to sound like this so that you look at me like an American, so that you look at me and you don't make fun of me. Oh, and then like even when I do speak perfect English, here you are openly mocking me, trying to become my freaking friend.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Trying to make a little joke.
Yeah, by the way, I'm very proud of myself, y'all, that I keep saying the word freaking instead of having to push our emergency dump button, because I have all sorts of rage.
Freaking rage.
Freaking rage when it comes to this topic. Yeah, I mean, it's just, how can it be 2017 and there's some dude going to Japan to study the culture, to bring back authenticity, and the one thing he brings back is delicious?
Oh, man.
Come on. What are sounds you, like he two?
Should, sounds like he should team with the ukiyo-e guy.
What if I went to like Kenya and studied like Kenyan cuisine or Ethiopian cuisine, and I came back and I spoke in like an African
accent,
you know, like that's totally cool though, right?
Well, you did.
Right? No, it's like that.
Well, you did.
How
was
that permissible?
To mess with people that you were Moroccan.
Oh, I didn't speak with an accent.
Yeah.
You know, I was actually just like trying to, it was like a setup to see what sort of ethnicity
reaction
white people would accept me as, because I am ethnically ambiguous. So I would say all sorts of things, but Moroccan was one of them, just because I knew that the people I was with didn't know where Morocco was.
Okay. Well, you know, when it comes to the accent thing, I do wonder, what is this chef trying to accomplish? Like, does he think it's entertaining his guests? Like, does he think that he is becoming more authentically Asian? Okay, but as Tabitha just said, like, okay, so...
Would you like to explain to us who the ukiyo-e guy is?
Yeah, okay, so this is more ridiculousness. This last weekend, I went to Denver, and I attended the Comic-Con. I'm a big nerd. So, you know, this is one of those places where everyone goes, like, at comic books, and you dress up like Superman and whatever. And you'll probably hear more about it on Radio Geekly in a couple hours here at 11 o'clock. Putting a little plug for our fellow nerds out there. So I go to Denver Comic Con, and I saw this artist who I saw here at the Portland Comic Con, and his work, let's put this out there first, it's a white dude, his work is Japanese woodblock prints. And I was always kind of like, it kind of rubbed me the wrong way, but I was like, you know, that is a really hard art, and if somebody's willing to like take the time to put in the hours to learn to do this, like, wow, that must be really amazing that he's learned to do this, right? So I go up and I ask him about his work. And I find out that he doesn't even make the art. Like, he designs the art, but he sends it back to Japan to have Japanese artisans carve out the wood block, and then they print it out, and they make the paper, and they do all the stuff, and then they
ship
that to him.
So outsourcing.
Yeah, he basically outsources his designs. Okay, so I'm like, right, so I'm already doing like all sorts of while he's explaining. And then he does the creme de la creme of white guy statements that I had heard that weekend. He says, well, you know, if it wasn't for me, you know, the Japanese woodblock industry, you know, is dying. So I am single-handedly,
white savior. Yeah.
He says, I'm single-handedly saving the Japanese woodblock industry. And he says this because I ask him, like, well, you know, you're doing all this stuff and you're profiting off Japanese culture. And like, so what are you doing to give back to the Japanese people themselves? And he says, well, I'm single-handedly saving.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay. And what are his prints? They're like Pokemon in the style of Japanese woodblock prints, like Avatar, like Naruto and stuff like that. I'm just like, no way. And so he's like, without me, 14 artisans in Japan wouldn't have jobs, and I'm planting a whole grove of mulberry bushes, because I guess that's how you make the paper. And he's like, without me, that grove wouldn't be there, without me, blah blah blah. And so I was just like, oh my God, because I felt my eyes rolling so far back in my head, I was afraid I was going to swallow them.
And I know exactly which guy you're talking about. Right? I've seen his work before, and I've walked by the booth, and I thought, oh wow, that's really pretty and cool, because I do like ukiyo-e prints. Now it's like, oh, I'm just going to feel dirty every time I see it.
Right, yeah. Just that, like, that white savior complex was so terrible. And I asked him, like, I was like, well, you know that your work is oppressive towards Japanese Americans. Like, maybe you don't fully get it, but, you know, it is oppressive. So what exactly do you do to give back to the Japanese American community? And he tells me that he goes to Sakura Matsuris, which are like these springtime festivals that happen, the cherry blossom festival specifically. And he's like, oh, yeah, you know, I table there and I pay my tabling fee. I'm like,
good.
How
for
is
you?
Paying a fee, know, like, yeah, giving back to the Japanese American community? Like, that is not like selfless at all, because you're making money, yeah, like, while you're there. And yeah, so it was just so, it's just been way too much just of like people taking our culture and being like,
and single-handedly saving
I'm
our
saving
culture
it.
Too.
It's delicious.
Well,
too much.
Well, how popular are ukiyo-e prints?
I will admit that, like, I'm not an expert on this topic at all, but I do know that, you know, like, the number of printers that you had, say, 200 years ago compared to now is obviously a lot less. So it's a very, very specialized field. And, you know, most people can't, like, afford to be a professional woodblock printing person all the time. And so, I mean, he tried to point out to me that he was, like, featured on Japanese TV and stuff like that.
Ooh, good for you.
Because he is one of these people who's putting actually quite a bit of money back into the woodblock industry compared to other people. But I will say that, yeah, if he has any sort of ideas that he is saving anything, it's like, no, job to save.
I really want to go to these artisans and, like, abscond them and do the art that you don't have to do Pokemon anymore. Do the art that you want to do.
Well, this is what I'm really hoping that it actually does. If it does anything good, is that maybe these artisans, when they're, because they have some money coming into their woodblock studios, they actually, like, have time to make other stuff off of the white man's money, white man's investment.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, okay, won't argue that a little bit, but
I do want to start my own art gallery. Maybe I'll find out who these artisans are. It's like, you know.
Oh, but can we talk about Asians saving themselves? Yeah. Like, while we're also just, like, talking about pop stuff.
Sure.
Can we all pre-applaud? Let's all applaud a little bit. Daniel Day Kim and Grace Park.
Yay!
Yes!
Speak up on your salaries. Get paid as much as your white co-stars.
Yeah, what's the backstory?
Who are these people?
So CBS did a remake of Hawaii Five-O. I used to watch that show growing up when I was a kid. And it stars Daniel Day Kim, which people might know from Lost, and Grace Park from my favorite sci-fi show, Battlestar Galactica, or the reimagined Battlestar Galactica series. Yeah. She plays a cool Cylon.
Spoiler alert, right there.
And they have other co-stars, but they don't matter. Anyways, they wanted to renegotiate their contracts and be paid as much as their white counterparts. CBS said no, and so they are like, well, we're leaving then.
Yeah, apparently it was quite the negotiation where they were trying to get equal pay, because for some silly reason, POC think that they should be paid,
I know, right?
Just as much as white people.
And women.
What?
Because I heard that, I know this is off topic, but Gillian Anderson, she wanted to get paid as much as David Duchovny, but Fox is like, no, back in the day of the X-Files.
Obviously, X-Files does not realize how boring of a show would be with just David Duchovny.
I know, right?
Anyhow, so Daniel Day Kim and Grace Park have left Y5O, and Daniel Day Kim just, like, released a little public statement that did acknowledge that he did leave over the pay issue. And then CBS comes back trying to, like, save their skin. And they say, well, you know, we did renegotiate. We did give them a higher salary, but it ended up being 2% less than the white actors. And they're acting like, oh, well, that's fine. You know, you were paid close enough. And they're also trying to, like, argue that they didn't have as much screen time, so they don't deserve as much. And it's like, well, why don't you freaking give them more screen time.
If they go, I watched the first episode of Hawaii 5-0 and it's like, okay, it was okay. It's just your standard procedural. But if there's a spinoff show with Daniel Day Kim and Grace Park, I'll totally watch that.
Oh my God, I would love that. It's like that would, they do their own show. But so like on Hawaii 5-0, the thing is that they were the two Asian
cast members.
And so you're going to have a show that takes place in Hawaii, and one, you have no Hawaiians on it, and then you're going to take off the Asians from the show. Like, what kind of freaking boring...
When I saw the pilot show, they were the only two actors of the main cast that I, like, even recognized.
Yeah, I mean, it's just... It just shows that, like, you know, Daniel Day Kim, like, how hard has that man worked? You know, here he is, he's nearly 50 years old, and you know, everyone loved him on Lost and everything. And
also, I appreciate that Grace Park doesn't speak with an accent, like on either Battlestar Galactica or Hawaii 5-0.
Yeah, they got to just like play themselves.
Yeah,
and but yet, like, it wasn't worth, their characters weren't deemed worth it.
It's only 98% good enough.
Yeah, they're only 98% good enough, and it's so disgusting. And I'm really glad that they didn't silently do this, that they really like came out and talked, you know, and made this a public problem and just really talked about like pay inequity. But one thing I liked in Daniel Day Kim's like public statement was, you know, he was like, yeah, this is about pay inequity. However, and I'm really sorry I can't be on the show anymore, but watch what I'm doing. I'm producing this, I'm starring in this, and I'm doing other things, you know. So hopefully, I like when he said he
can have a guest spot on Aziz Ansari's Netflix show.
Oh my God, if all the Asians could come together and just be on one awesome show. That, well, I mean, they have like Crazy Rich Asians. Have you seen the pictures for that?
No.
That's the name of a show?
No, it's a movie that's based on that book that came out a couple years ago. Anyhow, it's a cast of...
Would you like to enlighten us about this?
Okay, I don't know much about the book, but it was a really good selling book. It's a story that takes place in Singapore. Anyhow, it's being turned into a movie right now. And the amazing thing about it is that the whole crew is Asian. The cast is Asian. The director,
even
the producers.
Like all the people behind the camera.
Yeah, they're Asian. It's an Asian film. And this is going to be awesome because it's like Asian American and
yay,
or Singaporean. But anyhow, so like Constance Wu from like Fresh Off the Boat is in it. Basically, all your favorite Asians are in
Ali
it.
Ali Wong?
No, she's not in it. She's busy.
Well, she is in another show.
But yeah, so that's exciting. So even though we see these inequities with like Hawaii 5-0 and we're doing our own thing. We see like Fresh Off the Boat and like where Constance Wu is doing her thing. But then
this like once again brings up the complex idea of privilege, that Asians are in this position of privilege that we can, when white supremacist media doesn't give us the spotlight, well, we can go it. But it's like, I don't know if other POC groups could like muster the manpower to like make their own media.
Well, even if we wanted to keep going down that road, you know, like when we look at just like Asians, does it surprise us that the first kind of like big movie that like has an all Asian cast and crew and stuff is called Crazy Rich Asians?
Yeah.
You know, it's about Asians who have more money, you know, mm-hmm. and Fresh Off the Boat, even though the family isn't necessarily extremely wealthy, it's about like a middle class East Asian family. Yeah. That's who always makes the leaps, are the East Asians, and they're always being portrayed as middle class or upper middle class people. And so it does touch upon that privilege and like what white supremacy thinks is good for and like what is safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
As
yeah.
Ali Wong would put it, it's the jungle Asians versus the fancy Asians.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, that definition does not, I think Asians use it and we joke about jungle Asians versus fancy Asians, but it's a definition that has come to us from white people.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Southeast Asians are not seen as well educated, clean.
Right. Because all the soldiers had to go down there and save them from them jungles.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh. So, you know, it is telling when we see that. So it's like you want to be excited by the leaps forward that we're taking. At the same time, you can't help but notice like,
it's an East Asian family again.
It's all the East Asians. And, the people who left Hawaii 5-0 were Korean people.
Yeah.
Oh, why weren't they like Hawaiians?
Right. Yeah. Yay, good for Daniel Day Kim and Grace Park. I wish them great success in their future endeavors.
Yeah.
And also on this new show with Constance Wu.
Well, oh, no, it's a movie.
Movie.
It's going to be so good.
We should all go see the movie.
Okay. Yeah. Another thing to add to our list of movies that Tabitha always tells us, we need to all go see this movie.
We need to all go see this.
We need to talk
have
an
API movie night.
Okay. Can we talk about one last thing that made me sad this week? Uh-huh. Can we talk about the United Lady?
No. Oh, did someone else get punched in the face?
No. No, they didn't.
Oh, good.
Yay. That's the good news.
Not getting punched in the face should always be cause for celebration.
That's so sad when that's our existence.
I know, right?
So, Kanan, did you hear about the story about the United Lady?
Was this the person who, like, bought a ticket for their child, but their child, like, couldn't sit in it because the flight was overbooked or something?
Yeah, so the story basically is that this woman was traveling with her 2-year-old daughter, and she had bought a ticket for the 2-year-old because, according to United, you have to buy a ticket for somebody 2 or older. And so she buys the ticket, but for some reason, the gate agent doesn't end up, like, scanning the ticket, so that the
kid didn't get counted.
Yeah, so the plane thinks that the seat is open, and so they let somebody who was on standby sit in the seat. So when the flight attendant went up to the woman, instead of seeing the toddler strapped into this seat and asking, like, can I see your ticket, she just said, you need to carry your child on your lap. And then this is the sad part. So then the woman complies, and she didn't say anything. She didn't, like, question
it. And she paid
it
for this ticket.
Yeah, she paid $1,000 for the kid's ticket. For a 2-year-old, she paid $1,000 for the plane ticket.
Ugh.
She puts the kid on her lap, and the kid just has to, like, sit on her lap, or, like, and just, like, basically stood in the aisle most of the time, because the kid is, like, big and the woman was small. And only at the end of the flight did she find out, like, what had happened. And people asked her, like, well, why didn't you say anything? And then here's the sad part. She says, oh, well, I didn't want to say anything because I was worried, because I thought about Dr. David Dow, who was that man who was...
got punched in the face.
And dragged down the aisle, right?
Yeah.
And that whole thing. And so she said that she thought of him, and she thought about how when Asian people speak back on airplanes that they're at risk of violence. And she said that had she not had her daughter there, maybe she would have said something. But because she had her 2-year-old there, that she was, like, afraid for her daughter, so she said nothing. And, of course, the internet is all sorts to blaming her, because they're like, well, if they didn't scan the ticket, she should have said something. If she had just said something, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, do you know? No. You don't get to yell at her for not saying something, and then later probably yell at her for speaking up and not being a polite little quiet Asian woman like you want her to be. Like, no, no way. And she said that it was, like, traumatizing for her. And of course the internet is like, why is that traumatizing?
Well, hopefully her child isn't traumatized either, because...
Well, her daughter's too. She probably is okay.
I know, but, like, that's such a terrible... if the kid does remember, it's like, man, I had to sit on mama's lap the whole time. I had to stand.
Well, she probably will remember. It would be like, oh, mom, you remember the time we made the newspaper around the world? Like, because everybody's talking about it.
That was so much fun.
You know, and I think people don't want to talk about that. People don't want to talk about, like, they want to act like everything's this isolated incident. Like, oh, David Dow, Dr. Dow is this one little incident. It has nothing to
do with...
If
you speak up, you're not... Nothing's going to happen to you.
Yeah, it has nothing to do in the future. And it's like... Well, to me, this is just shows the historical nature of Asians within the United States. It's like one of us speaks up, and then that person gets beaten down, and then we stay quiet. And this is why Asians are, like, partially, it's me, it's partially the reason why we're so quiet generally here in the United States, because that's how we've gotten by.
Mm-hmm.
Is, like,
just
we've
keep
learned,
your head down.
Keep your head down.
Don't say
quiet.
Anything.
Yeah, and it's proof. Every time we see somebody speak up, it's like, oh my gosh.
It's like, no, what are you doing?
It's like, oh my
God. Put your head down.
Well, I mean, David Dow wasn't even just, like, getting yelled at. It was like, oh my God, this guy got, like, beat in the face and dragged with no
off
dignity.
The airplane, yeah.
And then was, like, doxxed and trolled to no end.
Yeah, ridiculed.
Yeah.
Humiliated. So Asians still fly steerage then. Right?
I guess so.
I mean, like, if that was a white family, I can't imagine that would have happened.
No, because you know what white mom would have done? Excuse me, can I speak to the head manager? Because never in my life.
Yeah,
blah,
right.
Blah, blah.
Right, it's like self-righteous indignation that doesn't come to Asian American people, especially, like, female-identified Asian American people because that is not something that's tolerated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine, like, I can't imagine being able to go anywhere I want in life and, like, in any situation and feel as though I can speak up and say, never in my life. And, like, oh, my gosh, can I speak to a manager? I can't believe I'm being treated this way. Like, I can't imagine ever feeling that freedom to just be out there. Oh, okay, we have eaten up all our time with just talking about whatever. We appreciate everybody.
APIs in the news.
Yeah, we appreciate you all tuning in.
And 4th of July.
About, I don't know, listening to us complain about whatever.
Chew the fat.
Chew the fat. Yeah, and, you know, we'll
complain
be on again.
White supremacy.
We'll be on again in 3 weeks. We are on, always on the 4th Friday will be our next show. So on July 28th, join us at 11 a.m. where we'll be talking about whatever comes to mind.
We're going to have an incredibly structured show. It's going to be the best show ever.
Maybe we
it's
can
gonna
have
be
our
a great
guests.
Show.
It's going to be delicious. No? Oh, there's no? Okay.
You've been listening to Pacific Underground with Tabitha Teo.
I'm Jenna.
I'm Kanan. And we'll catch you in 3 weeks.
Thanks for listening.
Liberation Literacy is a racial justice reading group at Columbia River Correctional Institution in Portland.
We are students of revolutionary politics that have long been forgotten. The Harriet Tubmans, the Nat Turners, the Angela Davises, and the Malcolm X's who recognized the systemic injustice in our country and saw themselves as active agents in fighting for change.
We meet weekly to discuss and reimagine the relationship between incarceration, our community, and ourselves.
Tune in to Prison Pipeline on July 10th to hear our discussion with National Book Award winner, historian Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, about his book, Stamped from the Beginning.
That's Prison Pipeline, July 10th at 6:30 p.m.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up at 10, we got Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with your host, Chris Andre. Followed at 10:15 with the Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And we thank Pacifica Radio and KPFA in Berkeley for sharing that with us here in Cascadia. It's 10 o'clock in the a.m. at KBOO Portland. All that and more is coming, so stay tuned.